Welcome to another episode of Blood, Sweat and Fears, the ultimate podcast where current and former sports people discuss the highs and lows of elite sports, the effect certain incidents had on them and their careers and their lives beyond their chosen pursuit. I'm Mark Clement, alongside me Scott Ward, a former professional footballer and the man behind EY's personal performance program, Building a Better Working World, and this podcast. And on this episode of Blood, Sweat and Fears, we're in the company of a former England international centre-forward. He won six major trophies with Leicester City and Liverpool. He also played for Birmingham City, Wigan Athletic, Aston Villa, Newcastle Jets and Bolton Wanderers. He scored over 150 top-flight goals and led the line for his country for over a decade, winning 62 caps. The only problem is, Emil Heskey, I've got a personal grouse because I'm a Middlesbrough fan. And in 1997, in the final minute of extra time, you broke my heart.
Yes, and Viv's as well. Yeah. I'm good friend with Viv. And
Viv Anderson.
He was the assistant, wasn't he?
He was, indeed. I mean, that moment when you've reached a pinnacle like that and you obviously went on to win the replay and you were young at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, that must just be the most beautiful thing, is it, to get off the ground?
Yeah, it was amazing. You know, coming from Leicester, then playing for your hometown team and the first full season, getting promoted, going to Wembley and getting promoted that way. And as you know, when you get promoted, the first thing that up into the Premier League, the first thing that they say is these three teams that have been promoted, they're the ones who are going to get relegated. Yeah. So we were odds on to get relegated, not to win a cup and finish top half of the table. So so it was exciting times, you know. So it was just great.
Yeah. I mean, a career obviously takes lots of highs and lots of lows. How do you look back? Is there a defining moment in your career, a moment that will always live with you, that was the essence of Emil Heskey?
Not everyone will remember the 5-1, won't they? Beating Germany 5-1 in their back garden. So I think that one everyone remembers, but signing for Liverpool was amazing. Going there, the end of the day, I'd come from a hometown team. I was a Liverpool supporter, so having them interested, had other clubs interested in taking me. But once they were interested, it was just kind of blinkers, wasn't it? So, then getting the opportunity to go there, I'd already won trophies. We'd been to three cup finals in 4 years with Leicester.
Yeah,
won two of them, lost one of them. I always say. The actual one against Spurs, I was injured, but I played. If I wasn't injured, we would have won it. So I felt that confident. But I had a back injury at the time, and I just wasn't at the races at that time. So, but to go to three cup finals in 4 years was amazing.
On that, Emil, as well. Obviously, going up as a player is pretty special, and Elliot and Darren have both done that a few times. Was there a moment in the Premier League where you thought, I'm good here and I could be better than Leicester? Was there a pivotal game or a moment that you remember that happening?
Not so much be better than Leicester. I just knew my own ability. I knew what I wanted to achieve, and I knew that I could achieve that. You got to remember, I played national team from the age of 16. Mm. So I was around that style of football and around them, the people that in the Premier League already. Especially younger lads. At 18, we come third in the Euros. The team that come first were France, Henri, Trezeguet.
Average team.
William Gallas, Silves, Anelka, Usman Darbo. I can carry on if you want. You're playing against these all the time and holding your own. And, it's great to be in and around that. So when I came into the Premier League, nothing really fazed me at a young age. And it never does when you're young.
Of course, yeah.
It never does when you're young. It's when you actually start overthinking things when you get a bit older. That's when things start to faze you.
Oh, well, that's interesting. Is that what happens? You're carefree, and then suddenly...
You just want to go on the pitch.
Yeah.
You want to play that 90 minutes. You want to nutmeg someone. You want to shoulder barge someone off the ball. And you want to play well and you want to score a goal.
Unfortunately for me, one of those always used to be smash the keeper as well. So it used to be me on the receiving end.
But so it wasn't, I never overthought things. And I had a great manager at the time in Martin O'Neill who His words to me were, get the ball, turn and run. He didn't tell me anything different. He didn't tell me anything else. So what I did, get the ball, turn and run. Created chances, created goals.
Was that question loaded in so much as you think a lot of players just don't realise how good they are?
I think the game's different, as Emma said now. The game's very, very different. And I think the thought process behind your ability has started at a far younger age. I think when we were younger, Emma and I aren't too dissimilar in age, and Darren would have been the same sort of age. I think that in terms of overthinking, that was my failing. So when I was younger as a kid, I was going to play for England, all the rest of it, because I just played the game. As soon as life got serious, which is when you start to think about stuff, it was completely different. You start getting more injuries, you start getting more tweaks. It's a lot of it's psychological, mm-hmm. but I think the other element to that is that people think about sports psychology, but the reason behind the program is also it's about the person. And if the person feels good, if the person feels confident, that will naturally have an impact on your sporting ability as well. So I think sometimes, as we've just agreed, you know, it is overthinking, but it doesn't always naturally start with sport. Sometimes it just be your life.
Mm-hmm. And it starts to creep into absolutely. Your thinking. Yeah. What were the people there in the background who were building you up, or was the nature of football that they would always try and bring you down a peg and think that that would motivate you, Emil?
Bit of both. Well, especially when you're in the youth setup, it's geared at the time. I won't say now, but at the time it was geared to bring you down and see who could swim. Mm. So whoever had the ability to take criticism, to take a bashing on a constant basis, but still push forward and put in for performances, they're the ones that were going to flourish. Some people just can't take criticism, just can't do it, and just can't. You need to be able to understand the different types of people that can. Yeah. Some people need an arm around them. Some people, do you just leave them alone? They'll figure it out themselves. Whereas in youth setup football back then, it was bash everyone. Whoever swam, they were the ones that you needed. Not necessarily like that, because you need the other ones as well. Because you need a blend of people. You don't just need everyone who's just hard and can take criticism and can take people in my sense, people throwing racial abuse at you and stuff mm-hmm. like that. It doesn't really matter. The people who can take that, yeah, great. But you need some other people as well.
Racial abuse. I mean, this is a hot topic at the moment.
Yeah,
I mean, look, that was a big part of the game when you were coming.
Yeah.
We're talking about this like it's the most natural thing on earth. It's heinous. Yeah.
You say we're talking about it was natural for us to deal with. It was from a very young age. I remember it from being a very small kid. I'm currently bringing a book out, my own book, autobiography, Even Heskey Scored. And... don't laugh.
I'm glad you've broken that ground. I can go there now.
Now, I put in the book about the racism side of thing, and when we were playing, we played Stoke, a youth level, and I only really played a few youth team games, and I was playing up front with another lad, and he was a year older than me. And they were giving it us both, yeah, kick that, yeah, blah, blah, blah. And like, you're thinking, he's saying it loud enough that everyone, this is an open field. This is at the training ground. So it's open, everyone can hear what he's saying. Yeah. The coaches are looking at, my coach was looking at his coach, you're going to say anything here? But it carried on for about 5-10 minutes. And then, it wasn't me who tackled. I think it was my strike partner tackled someone, but tackled him quite hard. Which is normal. You get a yellow card, or you just carry on. It's free kick, and you carry on. He's got up. He's on the floor. His defensive partners come running over. Oh, you black this blah blah. He's just instinctively, bang bang, give him a two piece. He's sleeping. He's got the other guy's got up, and then he's giving him two as well, and he's sleeping. They didn't realize he's used to box, so. But then this was normal for us. But now he's in trouble because he's actually physically put his hands on someone.
So you go and defend yourself for the same rights as anybody else in the world, and you end up getting penalised for it.
But it wasn't a normal in a sense of within youth football.
Yeah.
but it was normal.
Society.
Yeah.
Society. Yeah. And let's be frank, at times continues to be.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know? you go to a grassroots game.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and don't get me wrong, a lot of it can be pushed as banter. So I know my friend, my best mate, coaches youth football, and he will say some of the stuff that has been said. You know, we know what it is, but you cannot say, you can't say, oh, it's definitely racism, but we know what it is. We've got you coaching lads, you're doing the lads under 10s team, and because this black lad's good and he's quick and he's agile and blah, blah, oh, he's not 10. He's not 10, he's about 13, him, he's no blah, blah.
But I can't get over the compromise you have to go through as a young player where you're having to assimilate that and just accept it, despite the fact the world outside of football was starting to change, that there were black stars in music and cinema, you know, people were openly trying to move the boundaries one more stage, and yet you're just having to bury it.
Yeah,
so how does that affect you when you're sitting on something like that?
You just got to get on with it. There's nothing you can do. I'm not at the top. I'm not the leader at the top trying to thingy. I'm just a worker at the bottom trying to get to the top. So until you get to that top, you just got to accept what is going on and what you're having to deal with. We've got, like you're saying about, you're not allowed to stop until you're sick. I'll give you a funny joke. My best mate, we used to do in pre-season. I think it was the bleep test. So we were doing the bleep test. And he was the last one out. And with the bleep test, you're not supposed to stop until you actually miss.
Yeah, you miss
the
a beat. Yeah.
Beeps. Yeah. He just stopped. He'd beaten everyone. He just stopped and then laid on the floor. He said, I think he got cramp. But the coach was looking at him as if to say, what's he doing? How dare he stop? Blah, blah, blah. But this was the notion, you can't stop until you're sick or until you're beaten.
With all of this as well, what it does, it encroaches a normalized stress on you, mentally and physically, that you then take beyond the game.
Yeah.
So when you're out of sport, Em will know, if you walk into an environment, somebody will talk to you. As long as they're not swearing in your face, it's kind of acceptable. Because in the game, back in the day, you would be called everything. Right nose to nose, and you had to soak it up. The first job I remember I took, my then manager didn't talk to me. He used to walk past me, just blank me completely.
That's normal.
Because he wasn't swearing at me, I thought he was a nice guy. Whereas if you look now, that was terrible. Mm. My first proper job, I needed help. I needed hand-holding. But because he wasn't swearing at me, life was great. I was all right. And it's as we were saying. Mm-hmm. The problem is now sport at times normalizes such terrible pressures that it really does have a long-term impact. Mm-hmm. And again, it's part of the reason why we're looking at mental health in sport, but as a preventative action, not as a reactive measure. Because it's not all right that you have to become unwell and we then have to fix you.
Well, the funny thing that you're saying there about not speaking to your manager, I thought it was great when the manager wasn't talking to me. I thought it was great because when the manager's talking to you, I just thought I was doing something wrong. So I would like, you kind of be hiding from the manager at times. Yeah. And like, there were certain managers that when they spoke to you, everything was fine. When they don't speak to you, either injured or you've done something wrong in the game. And they'll look at you and walk past you like that. And not say, no hello, no nothing. So I got used to that. I was fine with that. Some people hated it. I know friends that are saying, he's that. I'm like, I'm quite glad he's not talking to me.
But surely in this day and age now, you couldn't get away without good communication skills, without being empathetic.
This is where certain managers are falling foul absolutely. Of and they're getting sacked because they're not galvanizing the group. You've got a group of players.
Yeah. A group of individuals, yes. Emil, who all have slightly different nuances as to what they want.
You've got to understand them. Yeah. You've got to keep them all together.
Yeah.
And some are not haven't had to have them skills over the years. So now they're trying to get them skills. They're finding it difficult and they're still thinking, no, this is the way it should be. I did it this way back then, blah, blah, blah. And they're just struggling.
Interestingly, we've just closed a global study where we interviewed athletes, coaches, parents and siblings. And 98% of the coaches that we interviewed said they want more personal development because they understand if they don't do that, they're not going to thrive. Mm-hmm. You can't, it's like the athlete coach, right? The players that we would have played with, Emil, when you retire, the environment expects you to then become a good coach. But you can't understand 50 emotional individuals who, by the way, really do need attention constantly.
Constant.
So if you can't manage that and manage that process for yourself, you can't be a successful coach. And it's the same with being a good player. It means if you're a good player, you're a good coach. No. Because if you don't manage your own development, your own psyche outside of the game, how do people expect you to have an extended dialogue at a level that appeases 30 lads in a changing room or women in a changing room? Mm-hmm. It's inconceivable. So the demand now from players, either in preparation to be a coach or life beyond, is huge around, look, I need to do more for myself.
Yeah.
And I think that the marketplace is wising up to that. The danger is when you're getting the managers or the coaches that feel like it's going to take away from what they're trying to implement as coaches or managers for their day-to-day delivery.
I don't see how that's going to take away. I think it's just going to advance what they will bring and what you'll get out of the players as well.
Absolutely.
Because yeah. I've seen it before where players just shut down. They just shut down. And having one player shut down in that team, you have a real bad knock-on effect. If he infiltrates another one, then he infiltrates another two. Suddenly you've got half a dressing room that don't want to play for you. And that's what you get. You get just people, and you've seen it at clubs. We've seen it all up and down the country. We don't know if it's happening at the bigger clubs. People are telling us it is. It looks like it is, but we're not in there, so we don't actually know. But it looks like it.
But you've seen that happen, that gradual, slow residual decay.
Yeah. When you just have a disconnect from your manager, and players are like, I can't be bothered to do this. Oh, and then blah blah blah, and he's in your ear. Now, you remember you're sat next to this guy 24/7. He's in your ear. Just knocks onto you and then you're in someone else's ear.
Can we talk to you about personal resilience? Because you mentioned even Heskey scored. Mm-hmm. And despite those accolades when I introduced you, you did become the beating stick for the England team mm-hmm. at times. Mm-hmm. First of all, do you have any regrets about playing such a selfless role, i.e. target man, lots of layoffs, holding the ball up and all that stuff, rather than having been a pure goal scorer?
No. Football is a team sport. Football needs team players. I'll give you an example. Simeone at Atletico Madrid. He builds a team. He doesn't really build. Yes, he might want to have one or two individuals that will give you something special every now and again. But generally, he builds a team that of people who understand what he wants and work hard. So I had something special when I was playing. I brought a lot to the team. I was very quick. I could take people on. And to be honest, when I was younger, there was no one like me. No one playing like me who could actually, all right, today I'm going to hold the ball up. Tomorrow I'm going to run channels. Mm-hmm. Next day I'm going to play in behind. I could do it a lot. I play left wing, right wing, centre forward, centre mid, right back, left back.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's lovely to hear you take pride in that.
Oh, yeah. But we've got plenty of players. James Milner, he plays right back. And he played left back, a right-footed guy playing left back, keeping a left back out of the team. And he's a centre midfielder.
But your satisfaction factor is gleaned from the fact that you are a team player, you are doing whatever it takes.
I'm not playing for media. I'm not playing for that. I'm playing for the team. I'm playing for the manager. This is what it's all about. This bunch of players that you have, these people that respect you and hold you in high stead. And the thing was, I never looked outside of that because I never wanted to. All the media stuff never really attracted me because everyone was, oh yeah, you're quiet. I'm happy being quiet. I don't need you to tell me that.
Do you think that's part of the problem though, Elmil, where you've got lads who are driven by
the media? We have, I don't know if it's a problem. But we definitely have people who are driven by that. People will go to the papers and look, oh, I've only got a six.
Yeah.
So I've got to do it. I remember a game. It was in the 2004 Euros. We played Portugal. Ashley Cole marked Ronaldo out of the game.
Yeah.
You know, he got a four or five in the paper. But he was the best player on the pitch. So he's got a four or five. Yeah. So are we all going to go off them? Can't go off any of these. It's just one person's view on it. Yes, he controls a wider variety of people by writing in a paper who read that and believe it's true. But it doesn't matter to me. It didn't matter to me a lot. It matters to some people.
Did you have to learn that?
Oh, yeah, 100%.
You did?
Yeah, 100%.
Because it goes back to what you're saying, isn't it, about personality?
Yeah. Yeah, because your only thought, you got to remember, I grew up as a normal person. So I would read newspapers.
Are you not normal now?
Yeah, but I'm saying I grew up in a councillor state, and
right.
You know, newspapers were your thing.
Yeah.
So you're reading that about them, but generally, when you actually get old and you look at it properly, you're thinking, these people just make up these stories half of the time just to make themselves look better or to sell newspapers. So I just looked at it and said, no, I don't really, you're not picking the team. Doesn't really matter.
But the barrage you got, did that? I know, look, we all say in front of lads, right? We say we're good, right? It's just normal response.
I wouldn't say it didn't hurt, because when you're reading, when you've been called back into the national team, and the news on the back of every newspaper is, oh no, not him. How are you going to feel?
Yeah.
There's millions of people looking at that. So I look at it and say, I was at that point where I was like, yeah, great. But I was 30 then.
That's what I was going to say. You're older then, right?
Yeah. Imagine if I got that hit me at 23, 24, 25. Mm. And I've seen it with players where they just gone, I was 30 then. I didn't care. Then they had to eat their words because I played well.
did it impede anything when you were coming out of the game in terms of what you could see yourself doing or opportunities you felt that people would give you? Was there any element of self-doubt
I'm guessing there would have been, not on my side. I would try anything, in a sense of when it comes to media stuff, I would try anything and talking about, happily talking about certain things. Even though I have won what I've won, I don't see the opportunities to go into deeper into the media side of stuff. I don't really see. I see myself. It's funny because I see myself as we've got a space. Oh, bloody hell, he's pulled out. Go and see if his meal's available. I see myself as that at this moment in time, which, you know, it is what it is. I'll try and push a bit harder, but it seems like it's a closed book at times. But I'm not going to get myself down about it. I've seen some people come out all guns blazing. I'm thinking, why would you say that? You didn't like that when you were playing. Right. So why are you doing it now? I don't know. It's maybe just to get a job. I don't because of what I've had to endure. I will never beat anyone down, because when you look at making football, you're in the top 1%, 2%,
1%,
1%, is it, of the people who wanted to be where you are. So you're an elite, regardless of what division you're in. You're actually an elite player.
Let alone if you then go on to be your country's centre forward for the next decade.
Yeah.
Were there any moments where you nearly crumbled under that scrutiny, under that pressure, that criticism?
The pressure was higher at the bigger clubs. So Liverpool, the pressure was immense. You have to be very, very... You have to have a great team around you when you're at a bigger club like that. If you haven't got a great team around you,
team, as in people off the field that were advising you, helping you.
People.
Did you see people, counsellors, coaches?
No, I didn't actually. I dealt with a lot of crap myself, which was tough. Yeah. In my book, I talk about when I first left Leicester and went to Liverpool, and that was tough because I'd moved out of my mum and dad's house, but I wasn't out of my mum and dad's house. If you understand what I mean, I lived around the corner and I spent most of my time there. but I had all my mechanisms around me. I had my mates, I had my mum, my dad, my brothers, everyone. I had my uncles, everyone. Just sit. If I wanted to go and sit with him, I can sit with him. If I wanted to go and sit with them, I can sit with them. And then I go up to this other place, and you got to remember, this is before all these stuff. So. No Google, no this, no that. So going to there and sitting there in an apartment that they'd given me, and I was like, I just broke down.
Yeah,
I didn't know what to do. But then I'd get back up, go to training, I'd be fine at the training ground. But then I had to get out of that comfort zone where I was sitting in an apartment, just looking at these four walls and not knowing what to do. And I had to get out of that, going nowhere to go to a shop. Where to go and get my haircut? I didn't get a haircut I was going back to Leicester and getting a haircut. And these are simple things, and especially within the black community, these are quite important things. And it was literally around the corner. But I'd not even explored, not even gone anywhere and known where to do certain things, where to go.
See, that's the typical point of dependency, right? So from the research we've done and everything else, that's part of why we struggle when we come out of sport, because you retain that level of dependency mm-hmm. on familiarization, mm-hmm. people that you know saying the same things, communicating in the same way. While it's a huge advantage to make sure you perform well, when you're talking about life choices outside of that cycle, it can really, really be pivotal towards mental health trauma mm-hmm. or not. And also marital status, mm-hmm. all of these things, it has such a big effect on it. And again, that's why it's so important we create holistic, well-rounded people during sport, so that you can go and get your hair cut. As ridiculous as it sounds, that's where people are. Mm-hmm.
So your dream for, say, elite football would be that there cannot be an Emil Heskey sitting in a flat without the club knowing about it, or at least giving him the option of being assisted. I mean, that seems like a basic. We had welfare officers years ago for the foreign lads coming in, didn't
but
we?
We have that at the club, but it's down to the person as well, because I didn't feel that I warranted going to him and asking for a little bit of help to do this and to do that. And even just being around, just to even, because he wasn't far from me, so even just sitting at his house, just have someone next to me.
But it's, you know, back in the day, if you're a welfare officer, it would be help you get a house, mm-hmm. tell you where the local supermarket is, arrange your travel plans. And now it's more than that. It's more than making sure that your light bulbs are fitted or you know where your barber is. It's about ensuring that, again, it goes back to happiness. If the lad's happy, irrespective of where you've come from, then you're good, right? And you can ask him to do more or less anything you want in training and so on. It's still a pivotal part that is missed, because we don't see it as advantageous for what we want out of them for a £20 million price tag. Mm-hmm. And we alluded to it earlier. The danger is that we think this only affects lads that play in the Premier League for the country. It's all the way down. Mm-hmm. Because if you're a footballer, you're a footballer. You still want to play for your country. We've mentioned it when we had Dino on, didn't we? Because you play for Accrington or you play for Oxford or Exeter. Trust me, you want to play for Liverpool, Man United and Arsenal. It's just that you're not currently there. But that doesn't mean we should impede what you have access to. Mm-hmm. And again, the other end of the spectrum is, because you play for Liverpool, Arsenal, Manchester United, you're okay. Because you've got a couple of quid, you're okay. I'm telling you, everybody knows now, that is also a contributing factor to some of the bad things that are happening to people that we know. Mm-hmm. Because the assumption is dangerously, well, they're fine.
Well, the assumption is you get paid this much money, so you should be able to get all that round you. But then again, your agent should be doing this. There's no accountability with anyone. It's, he should be doing that. Well, why isn't the club doing it? And then the PFA, why not FA? The Premier League. So there's all these number of people that everyone's just pointing their finger at everyone else. And then the players stuck in the middle thinking, well, what do I do?
Too worried to ask, as you said. I don't want to ask the question because I don't want to seem silly, or I shouldn't be asking that question. I don't deserve it. Mm-hmm. Nonsense. In any other walk of life, you ask questions freely. It's how you become more evolved. But in sport, it's deemed as a weakness, or if you ask that question, you're a problem. I've heard managers speak about it before. If you're one of those lads that asks too many questions, he's a bit of a problem. I'm going to get rid of him and I'll get somebody else and he doesn't.
Oh, goodness.
It's the same. It's exactly that. But again, it's that level of exposure and maturity, I think, that needs to change in the environment to allow us to express things.
As well, it's a case of your upbringing as well. If you're encouraged to ask questions from your family members or your parents, you'll generally do that and not feel any way. Like, I went to school and I sat at the back because I didn't want to ask any questions. So then going forward, I'm going to be the same person. I'm not going to ask no question. I'm just going to watch what you're doing and then try and mimic it.
Yeah. As a result of you being quiet, and you've just given us an example that goes right back to childhood, do you find people are surprised to meet you and hear that you are as knowledgeable, as seemingly happy in your own skin as you are, and richer for those experiences you went through? So that comes with age,
but
it comes as a result of knowing you can be resilient and get through some of those bad experiences.
Yeah, definitely. I've got friends who've got kids who are going to be playing now, and I constantly tell them certain things and make sure they're watching over their kids and looking at different signs. And it's funny because one of them got in contact with me, and I've known this woman for years. Our dads are best mates, so that's how long I've known her. And her son plays, and I was telling her about some of the stuff that I was going through, and she goes, I saw that in my son when he went on loan up to Scotland.
Yeah.
Because, you just got to be careful. You just got to be around him. And people won't pick it up, but you, being a parent, you'll pick it up and you'll know. So just be careful and just be aware of what's going on.
That's why the parents need development as well, because if you look at my experience, my family went from zero to four sons playing pro football. Mm-hmm. How are we expecting them to be okay with it? Mm-hmm. The people coming towards them, how we communicate with other people. Be humble, kids. Don't show anyone that you're proud of yourself. Why not? Mm-hmm. As Emil said, 1%. Mm-hmm. All four of us were all pro footballers.
And we shared to the four winds as well.
But this is it.
You're all playing on the same day at different areas of the country.
Exactly.
Mum and dad's loyalties
How
are split.
Do you manage that? How do you then have to sustain your own personal jobs? You know, I said before, my dad used to come home at silly o'clock after a double shift, take one brother to Ipswich, then he's coming back from there, taking Darren to Watford. You know, we're not making sure that they're all right. And then they're expected to manage their son or daughter's career as professional athletes under the scrutiny now that they are with social media. Mm-hmm. Now, again, if you don't know, you don't know. We as athletes suffer from that. Mm-hmm. We expect more from ourselves because other people do. Mm-hmm. So it's about not receiving the expectancy from other people, but having some for yourself based upon what your current knowledge is. Mm-hmm. So we need to give that to, as I said, to parents beyond the initial pre-season. This is what the club's going to do. It needs to be a continuum, yeah. A sharing forum for all of the parents so that they know they're getting good advice from people that have.
Well, my boys are at Man City, so they do as much as they can to help. And like you're saying, I don't know how your parents did it with four. I've got two doing it, and it's a job.
Yeah,
it's a job. You take them here. Like, I've just dropped one off to football this morning. Got my wife's picking him up at 1 o'clock. Then got to drop another one off later. One's going to Poland to play in a tournament. Then I've got to pick him back up from there. Then. And at one stage, one was training in the morning, 10 till 1, and the other one was training in the evening, 5:30 till 8. Just out all the time driving, dropping them off, doing this and that. So Man City help a lot, but they have the resources to help.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
They have the resources. They put on buses. They pay your petrol allowance. So they do a hell of a lot. But they have the resources to help, and they're willing to go out there because they understand it. And they understand that you being in the right environment with your kids and in being in a good environment with your kids helps them with their progress through their football.
Yeah. Which is exactly what you've been saying all along.
Yeah,
which is exactly one of the central tenets of your entire program.
Of course, it's critical. If you don't have happy parents, you won't have happy players. Mm-hmm. But it's something that we seem to ignore at times. You know, the dialogue between parents and clubs isn't always fantastic. And obviously, as Emil said, it's variable. But it's an essential part. But then also the parents need a transition from when your son or daughter goes from a scholar to a full-time in letting go and understanding that they need to be parents, not coaches. Mm-hmm. So it's an ecosystem of development. But it's not a challenge. We just need to be able to talk about it in a really open fashion.
I love this, but I've got to ask you one final question. You've been out 3 years now. Mm-hmm. Do you know what you want to do with the rest of your life?
No, because we were never... The thing with football is... I see it differently now, but with football, it was... I was told even at Liverpool, you're not allowed to go shopping. Mm. You're not allowed to walk around. You've got to rest. Let your wife do this, do that, blah, blah, blah. You sit down, put your legs up, blah. You're not allowed to go and do this. You're not allowed to... I'm like, what can I do? What do I do? Oh, let me play on a video game. Oh, I don't like this. And I never really got into video games.
Yeah.
So then I never really got into golf. But then they say, don't play golf because, you know, walking around for 4 hours, it's no more exercise. So never, I played 21 years and never got badges. But the amount of time you have to yourself is phenomenal. You're training for... Maximum 4 hours.
Maximum.
So you feel that's wasted. You feel your downtime was wasted time.
Wasted. Whether it be you look at different businesses or ventures, but you've got to stimulate your mind. Because one thing I found tough at times was you've got a game, you've played the game. You can't switch off from that game.
Yeah.
Whether it be good or bad, you can't switch off. And if it's bad, it's worse, obviously. Yeah.
Especially if you're an overthinker like I
was. Yeah.
So having been absolute top level, and I assume you've done all right for yourself, would this be enough to sustain you for the rest of your life, doing bits and pieces, getting the kids through, finding...
Well, there's a difference though, isn't it? There's a difference about mental sustainability and financial one. And again, it goes back to what we've said. Just because you're financially okay, it doesn't mean that you're going to be mentally stimulated for the rest of your life.
No.
And Emil said about the challenges around having spare time. what we've developed, we've had to make sure it appeases not only the coaches and the sports organisation, but also the player. So you can do it face-to-face, but you can also do it online. So if you are after a match mm-hmm. and you're thinking, I can't switch off like I would be, then you can go on your mobile phone and you can actually do something that's going to develop you as an individual at that time where you can't switch off, which means it's not impeding in what people want, but it's fulfilling your demand as a person, which is natural, which is to be better. Mm-hmm. And again, I think now players are speaking more openly about, you know what? Football's not enough. No. Now, what that means is different to everyone. But in terms of knowing more and having better knowledge, and you can tell that obviously with yourself looking to subscribe on some new courses, mm-hmm. people what want to be better.
The UEFA MIP master's course is just is to help ex-players get back into football, and, but in the management area. So the thing is as well, I don't know if it's something that I want to do, but I'm looking at exploring that because at the end of the day, you look at the clubs. There's one club in particular that I look at is Ajax.
Yeah.
What do? They employ ex-players to come back.
Yeah.
They teach them. They market them. They give them the jobs that brings wealth back to the club. And what happens? They're one of the most the most wealthy and well-run football clubs in the world. You look at what they do, you look at their business plan. They have 18-year-olds coming into the first team, knowing that within 1 year, possibly 2 years maximum, that player is going to be sold. So I need a 16-year-old, I need a 14-year-old who I know that the next two generations are taken care of that position. There's a young lad, he's just gone. But now they've got another lad, 18.
That's what I mean. But last season, they were talking about it as if Ajax doing as well was a fluke. This is a long-term plan.
This has been going on for years. Yeah. Go back to Edgar Davids.
Exactly.
Clarence Seedorf.
Yeah.
Mario Melchior. We can go back.
Yeah.
We can keep going back. These players have been doing it for years. So it's a case of looking at that and trying to get back into football that way.
Listen, I think this conversation needs to continue at some stage in the future. We're going to get you on again. That was fantastic. Thanks for coming to see us.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
That's it for this edition of Blood, Sweat and Fears. For more information about the programme itself, please visit our website. That's ey.com/UK/personal-performance-programme. This podcast and future episodes in the Blood, Sweat and Fears series are available on iTunes and via the EY website by visiting ey.com/UK/PAS/podcast. Thanks again to Emil Heskey and indeed to Scott. I'm Mark Clement, brought to you by EY, building a better working world. Thanks for listening to the latest episode of the Ultimate Podcast, with a focus on athlete experiences, readiness and preparation for life in and out of sport. Goodbye.